Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Business Book Show. Today, it is my sincere pleasure to have as our guest Mignon Fogarty. And this amazing woman has helped, God only knows how many people, fall in love with writing again. She has made an entire business, an entire lifestyle out of not just being a grammar, not just correcting grammar, but of helping people get more comfortable with the nuances that is grammar. I think a lot of us come from the background where our English teacher, our professors, you know, made us feel like things were black and white, and that you know, so many of us don't know all the rules of grammar, and so we feel like that we're all constantly, you know, writing, and people are constantly criticizing us. One of the things that I love about her approach is helping you realize that there's a lot of gray, there's a lot of usage, things change over time. I mean, she is, and I hope that this isn't really going, you know, overboard, but she really is like the strunk and white of our generation. She is, she's amazing. So a little bit of gushing there, but on a more objective level, she is the author of a number of books, including, in fact, I've got in my hands right here, Grammar Girl Presents the Ultimate Guide for Students. One of her first books, Grammar Girl's Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing, was a New York Times bestseller. Her more recent book is The Grammar Devotional, Daily Tips for Successful Writing. And then she has a number of other books and resources that you can find on Amazon. But what she is known for is her podcast. She does an amazing podcast where she, believe it or not, is one of the most popular podcasts in the world. And it is on grammar. It's on how, you know, to use words. It's on what makes sense and then what doesn't. And she does it in such a way that it makes it fun. You get off of there feeling like you want to go right. You feel inspired, not just, okay, well, I learned something else I've been doing wrong all this time. She does a beautiful job of helping us appreciate language. I guess that's really the best way to put it. All of that to say, Mignon, excuse me, I keep on saying Mignon because my son is in love with Minions. Mignon, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. If this were a video podcast, people could see that I'm blushing.
Well, good. Then my job is done. My job is done here. So listen, you know more, you've probably forgotten more than I will ever learn about the nitty gritty, how to put words together, how to actually write, how to do all of this. And you've been helping people online and in the real world for years. So can I just give the floor over to you and you talk to us about what it's like to write?
Sure. Well, you know, it's funny that you say I've probably forgotten more than you know, because one thing I always start by telling people is that I have to look things up every day too. There are just so many rules to remember, the nitpicky little details, that I don't think anyone could remember all of them, to hold that all in your brain. You know, some of my favorite reference books, you know, Garner's Modern English Usage, for example, it's 900 pages long. You know, nobody can remember all of that. So it's really important to have good references, know where to look up things. And, you know, if you don't know, go look it up or rewrite your sentence to write around the problem, which is what I often did before I became Grammar Girl. I was a writer and editor, and I would just say, I don't know how to phrase this, or I don't know what the rule is. So I would rewrite my sentence. You know, now that I'm providing advice to people
that's
and
my
answering
go-to
questions, I actually have to go find the answer. So, and it's always fascinating. I mean, the reason I still love doing the Grammar Girl podcast after 10 years is, you know, probably maybe not every week, but every other week when I do my show, I come across something that I find fascinating that I didn't know. Or, you know, when we were talking before the show, you mentioned, you know, the difference between critique and criticize that I did I think I did the difference between those last week in my show. And you know, I had no idea there was such an interesting history, and you know, they were contentious in the past, and you know, despite the you know, there's the recent, you know, you can think of, well, the difference is when you criticize something, it's always negative, but when you critique something, you could be providing more of a broad overview of the good and bad points. But you know, there's been an ongoing debate in the usage world about whether one can be used as a verb or a noun, and you know, it's always fascinating to go back and look at words people thought were, you know, horrifying or outrageous, you know, back in the 50s or something like that. So I just find language fascinating, and that's what keeps me doing it.
Well, you know, your love and fascination of language absolutely comes through in the podcast, in your books. And it is refreshing to know that even after 10 years of doing a podcast and being the grammar girl, that you're still looking up things every day and learning something fascinating every week or every other week. For those of us who love language, that is that's hopeful to know that you never get to the end of it, that there's always something else to learn.
Yeah, there's always something. Just the other morning, my husband said he felt perky, and I was drinking coffee, and I thought, I wonder if perky is related to perking coffee. You know, and so I because coffee makes you feel perky, and you perk coffee. So I went and looked it up, and actually, they aren't related. So I was disappointed, but you know, there's
really?
Always something to look up. Yeah, yeah, I absolutely thought they would be related, but perky comes from, I think it comes from birds preening their feathers back in the 1600s or something like that. But I was so disappointed they weren't related.
I love finding sayings that we take for granted, especially in the oddest places. So two books, one I think that really blew my mind about how many different things that we take for granted and how we say things, or even in some of our little kind of cultural idiosyncrasies here in the United States, traces back to the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. And I had no idea of any of it until I read Devil in the White City, which is absolutely one of my favorite narrative nonfiction books. But, you know, just in talking about, you know, the parallel between building the Chicago World's Fair and the serial killer that was operating in Chicago at the time, I got to learn about language. I love whenever authors can do that, can slip in, you know, a little bit of learning, so that you learn even while you're being entertained, which is probably certainly one of the nicest ways to learn, if not the easiest.
Yes, I've heard other people recommend that book. It's definitely on my to-be-read pile. I have it, but I haven't read it yet, and you're making me want to get to that, get to that book.
It really is. It's really a great book. But coming back to us writing our own books, tell us about, I guess one of the things that I see whenever I'm working with authors or talking to authors who or people who want to become authors and writers, they get so, they're so fearful, they're almost to the point of being paralyzed about whenever they sit down to write, not knowing, you know, they feel like that almost every other word they're going to have to look up to make sure that they're using the word correctly. And they overthink it, I think, and they stop themselves before they even start. There are plenty of great books that have probably never made it out of somebody's head because the person thought that they needed to have you know, a master's in fine arts or you know, be an English teacher before they were worthy enough or before they knew enough to write a book. So for those kinds of people, what would you say?
Right. Well, the most important thing is to realize your first draft is just a first draft. And not only does it not have to be perfect, it's never going to be perfect. It can't be perfect. So don't feel like, you know, you're failing if it's not. And don't let that stress over feeling like it has to be perfect stop you. It's just a draft, and its only purpose is to get your ideas out there in a way that then lets you refine them. So, and I know it can be really intimidating to sit down in front of just a blank screen, that blank white screen that you suddenly feel like you have to fill up with genius. A couple of important things that can help with that are, number one, you don't have to start at the beginning. If you have, you know, an idea that, you know, an important point or an idea, or if you're writing fiction, a scene that's in the middle of your book, go ahead and write it down. You don't have to start with the introduction, the foreword, chapter one, then go to chapter two. You can write out of order, and that's often a good way to get over your anxiety about writing, and because, you know, you don't feel like you're crafting from the beginning. This is just an idea that you want to capture for later. So that's one way to get over the stress. And number two, when I was writing the grammar devotional, which is sort of like a tip-a-day calendar in a book form, so it's 365 daily tips, and I started with a spreadsheet, and I wrote down, you know, the ideas for each day, and it just became cumbersome and overwhelming. And what I did is I switched to Post-it notes, and I took a huge wall in my house. Now, I don't have a lot of huge walls in my house, so it was in my hallway. So in the hallway, I would write ideas on Post-it notes, and then I would put them up on the wall. And then once I had, you know, maybe 100 of the 365, I just started moving them around, physically moving them around, in ways that made more sense than how I had originally arranged them. You know, so once I had so many, I knew that, just a general interesting word, we'd do all those on Mondays, and maybe punctuation would be Wednesdays, and, you know, then I would see, oh, this tip relates to that tip, so I'd move them closer together. And just being able to physically see them all at the same time in real live space in my house made it a lot easier to conceptualize the big picture of the book. And so, and I know I've heard other authors say they do the same thing. Sometimes they'll print, you know, fiction authors will print out scenes and move them around on a table and things like that. Now, there's software that lets you do that. Scrivener is a book writing software that has virtual Post-it notes. And I've tried to use that, but it just doesn't. The physical Post-its work better for me than virtual Post-its. But I find, you know, getting out into on paper and physical space often can help to overcome that blank page anxiety on your computer.
I love that image of a wall in your house being filled with Post-it notes that you just keep moving around and unstick and restick over here. I guess you had to get the expensive kind that, you know, where the actually held on over age. Sometimes I'll get the El Cheapos that, you know, after about two or three sticks, they're done.
And when the book came out, I was actually really sad when I had to take all the Post-its down eventually. I'd grown fond of them. My family, not so much. You know, so then...
That is funny. I've heard. I'm with you. You know, I like printing them out. I like Dan Pointer calls it the pilot method, where he'll pile, you know, the late Dan Pointer would pile ideas together. I like to use the mental image of buckets, right? That I have these buckets, and we put stuff in these different buckets, and then those buckets eventually become a chapter. But Post-it notes on the wall, that is a new one.
Right. It's just, you know, really simple. And then, you know, okay, so then you have your first draft, and maybe it's not even completely done, but at some point you can go back and start editing it, cleaning up the language, writing it, looking things up you aren't sure about, or rewriting sentences. You could join a writing group, you know, find a writing group in your area and have, you know, people who are willing to read the draft for you and give you feedback about, you know, usually the feedback is more useful about whether things are clear or make sense or inspiring. But, you know, if you have
a person like me in your writing group, you might also get some free copy editing. And then, all the way to, you know, hiring an editor in the end to clean it up so that you're just really confident that it's absolutely as perfect as it can be and as professional before you publish it. So, you know, you don't have to know everything yourself. You know, that's why people hire, you know, artists to do the cover for their book. And it's the same with, you know, if you want to, you can hire an editor to clean up your text, you know, or you can go out on your own. But, you know, it just depends on you know, how you feel about it, how perfect it needs to be. But, you know, if you feel like it needs to be perfect and that's completely stressing you out, you know, there are people you can hire to help with that part of it, just like you might with cover design. So that's another thing to keep in mind if you're feeling anxious.
Let's talk about a couple of quick and dirty tips for people, especially you know, in the initial stages where they're trying to get their ideas down, and they don't want to or they know, you know, they have accepted and embraced the fact that they can come back and edit it later, or that they can even hire you know, a professional to come in and edit it. So, but if they're just, you know, trying to write, let's talk about a couple of easy tips and tricks. The first one being the one you said you use, the one that I still is probably my number one tool, is to write around a word. If you come up against a phrase or something, then you're not quite sure. So kind of give us what that looks like and how you used it in the past. And then if you have any other kind of really broad, easy to use, quick and dirty tips like that to help people who are, you know, who are trying to write without, you know, the Chicago Manual of Style. By the way, I'm still jealous that they sent you a galley copy of the next one.
I know, I was so excited to get that. Here's an example. Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay, so here's an example of a question someone asked me this morning on the Grammar Girl Facebook page. It went something like this. So she had a sentence, "This is one of the books that has or have inspired me over the years," right? So one of the plural noun, I always have to look up whether it should be then a singular or plural verb to go with it. I cannot remember that rule. So after we're done here, I'm going to go look it up and then answer her question. Excuse me. I'm going to go look it up and answer her question. But you could just rewrite the sentence and say, "This book has inspired me." You know, so instead of saying, "This is one of the books that has or have," you could say, "Just this book has inspired me." So that's, you know, a really simple way to rewrite that sentence when you're not sure which verb to use. And basically no one knows which verb to use in a sentence like that. So, when I talk to other language experts, sometimes I'll say, you know, if you and I can't remember the rule, like, it probably doesn't matter which word they use because nobody knows. and just a couple of other things that come up all the time, very common questions. So in American English, periods and commas go inside a closing quotation mark. So if you're ending a sentence with a quote, you put the period inside that closing quotation mark. They do it the opposite way in British English. So I think that's why people are often confused. They see it, you know, done different ways online. But in edited American English.
Yeah, British punctuation makes so much more sense to me. It just seems so much more logical in that it actually obeys the rules. Whereas with American punctuation, you know, the if you have a question mark or an exclamation point, it often goes inside the quotation marks, but if putting it inside the quotation marks, say if you were referring to the title of a movie or something, if the question mark or the exclamation point would change the meaning of what's inside the quotation marks, then you put the mark outside. That just
right. It's very confusing.
Why can't why can't we just be British? Why can't we just be British?
Right. And then another thing people ask about a lot is when you use a or an before a noun. So a lot of people, so it's the sound of the next word that determines whether you use a or an. So if you're writing about someone who has an MBA, even though MBA starts with a consonant, the letter M, you use an MBA because it actually starts with an E sound. It starts with a vowel sound when you say it out loud. So a lot of people were taught just, look, is it a noun? Is it a consonant or a vowel? And it's not whether it's a consonant or vowel letter, but it's whether it's the consonant or vowel sound. So that's another question I get all the time.
Yeah. You were talking about you know, if somebody who really knows, you know, doesn't even know, then maybe it doesn't matter. That reminds me of in Strunk and White's Elements of Style. It says whenever Strunk was a professor, he used to shout at his students, if you don't know how to pronounce a word, say it loud. If you don't know how to pronounce a word, say it loud.
Right. What's so funny about that is people would say that's grammatically incorrect, but he should be saying, say it loudly. So it's especially funny because of that.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that sentiment kind of captures the heart of language. So, you know, we have all of these rules and these guidelines and all of these things to help aid communication, to help lessen the chance of a miscommunication or a misinterpretation. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is to communicate, right? So punctuation and the rules of grammar, they help us communicate, but they're there to support us, not to dictate to us. So the most important thing is to make sure that we're sharing our ideas, we're sharing these words, we're sharing these things with the world. And then, you know, having them using the rules of grammar and punctuation to make them as clear as possible, to make sure that they're as intelligible as they can be. That's the purpose of those tools, but they're tools. They're not the point.
Right. They help you get your point across, but good storytelling and the content of your message, whether it's inspiring, whether people find it useful, is definitely more important than having perfect writing. And I think, you know, the thing I always think about that just make that point so clearly is you look at some of the bestsellers in the last 10 or 15 years, you know, 50 Shades of Grey, Twilight, The Da Vinci Code. You know, you'll hear people who are sort of snobby about writing, you know, going on and on about how terrible those books are, how terribly they're written, how the writers can't write at all. It's just painful. But, you know, I picked up The Da Vinci Code, and as I was reading through it, I was like, oh, this writing is so bad. But I couldn't put it down. I could not put that book down. And, you know, millions and millions of other people feel the same way. So those authors are doing something right, and it has to do with storytelling and human emotion and, you know, I think that, you know, you really need to look at what those kind of people are doing and why it works. And, you know, a book doesn't sell because it has perfect grammar and perfect punctuation. It sells because it has a message that resonates with people, something that people enjoy and that people find useful and compelling. And that's the most important part. And then, you know, getting the technical details right, you know, that sort of just makes you look more professional and insulates you against criticism. Bad reviews.
I'm going to quote you on that. A book doesn't sell because of perfect grammar or perfect punctuation. I'm going to quote you on that.
You bet.
Go ahead.
Necessary but not essential, or I forget what that phrase is. necessary but not sufficient. I'm getting it wrong.
You're talking about, you know, people criticizing Twilight and 50 Shades of Grey. It makes me think of the time I read about someone was criticizing, you know, these children's books, you know, Goosebumps or maybe some of these other ones that, you know, they were so elementary that, you know, there wasn't really, you know, a whole lot of challenge there, or that they were so easy. And why couldn't, you know, why are these kids reading, you know, Goosebumps and Twilight whenever they could be reading, you know, Tom Sawyer and or, you know, some literary classics. And I, you know, I thought to myself, but it's the wrong comparison. You're saying, you know, why don't these kids, you know, try reading these other classic books? But really, if these kids weren't reading, you know, Twilight, they would be, you know, watching a movie instead. So the fact that they're reading Twilight instead of watching Twilight, I mean, that's the win. So maybe they read Twilight. Maybe
to...
Yeah.
I remember hearing a story about a book signing where, you know, mothers were coming up and saying to the author, you know, thank you for getting my daughter to read, you know, so, you know, just finding things that kids like that they can read is the first step. And then, you know, you hope that they develop a habit of reading and move on to more challenging books or, you know, but just getting them reading and developing that habit is a really great first step.
Yeah, that's the it makes me think of my dad. He had a particularly mean first grade. Well, maybe I shouldn't say first grade teacher, because maybe somebody will look it up and figure out who it is. Anyway, so he had a mean elementary school teacher that would she'd whip the kids. She'd give you one paddling for every spelling word you missed on your test. And so my dad just, you know, came to have this hatred is too strong of a word. My dad's too wonderful of a guy to really hate anything, but just this distaste for, you know, reading and language. And he shied away from it ever since then, just because of those awful associations. And his mother couldn't get him to read for anything. But my father he's an engineer now, so he's, you know, very mechanically inclined. So his mother started getting him like Hot Rod magazine subscriptions or car subscriptions. And this was back in the 60s, I guess. And my dad would read him cover to cover because he was in love with cars and in love with the content.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's such a great idea. And, you know, I think that you don't encourage learning by telling people they're stupid or punishing them for making mistakes. I think you encourage learning by being positive and supportive and, you know, helping students find the ways that work with them to learn to read and write. You know, some kids are going to enjoy poetry more than others. Some kids are going to want to write their personal stories. You know, some kids are going to want to write fiction. It just, and finding what they enjoy, and, you know, enjoy spending time doing and encouraging that, I think, you know, is the best way, you know, for parents to get their kids reading and writing. You know, in schools, they have things they have to do and lesson plans they have to follow. But when you're a parent trying to like, you know, support that and develop things that you think are important, you know, during the summer, keep your kids doing interesting things, you know, let them choose what they want to read or work on or write. You know, when I think that studies have shown when students are able to choose their own books, they're much more likely to actually finish them and say they enjoyed reading them.
Yeah, and bringing this back into the discussion of, you know, helping business authors actually write their books, one of the underlying ideas in here is focusing on the content and delivering a book that people actually want to read. And even if you're not a great writer, or even if, you know, it's a magazine instead of a full-length book, just the fact that people are actually reading it and absorbing it is the win. So like you say, you know, if you have a professional criticism of the Da Vinci Code, but yet you loved the book and couldn't put it down. And I mean, I read the Da Vinci Code, I read Angels and Demons, read Inferno. I love Robert Langdon. I love him bringing all this, you know, history together, and I think he does a great job of storytelling. So that's the, and you know what, actually, and forgive me for putting so much of myself in here. There is a book I'm reading, Shantaram. I think that's how you pronounce it. Shantaram, Shantaram by Gregory Roberts. It is beautifully written. He is an absolute master of language. I mean, I don't say this often because in my heart of hearts, I'm an evil person and I'm quite critical and judgmental, although I try to hide it quite a bit. But I sit down with that book and I am in awe of his ability of language. I love it. But do you know that I haven't finished the book yet because it is so slow? I haven't finished the book. <haven't.
laughs> There's a difference between fantastic writing and storytelling that pulls you through a book. I mean, I think that, you know, when you have that, let's say you have that first draft, you know, then you can go back and look at it and say, is there anywhere I could use alliteration, you know, Grammar Girl with the two G's, that's alliteration, those similar sounds. Yeah. Is there anywhere I can add some alliteration? Is there anywhere maybe I could add a metaphor? You know, life is a highway. You know, you can go back and try to make your writing more beautiful, you know, if you are inclined to do that. But the most important thing is getting that first draft down, because if you don't get it out there, you're never going to write your book. So, you know, you have to start, and letting go of the idea that it has to be perfect when you start can really, you know, get you going and get you on the path to getting your book out there, which is what you really want. So don't let perfect be the enemy of good. And, you know, you can always go back and make it more beautiful, make it more perfect, but make it more accurate, but more perfect is probably not a good phrasing, because perfect is an absolute. Like, you know, I'm catching myself in a little language error there. But, you know, nobody's perfect, actually. You know, but I'm not perfect either. So I have an editor who goes over my stuff, and sometimes she misses things too. You know, you can have two or three people look at something, and they will still miss a typo or something. So, you know, nothing. I doubt there is a single published book out there that is absolutely perfect. First of all, they all have at least one typo. And, you know, your first draft is just a first draft. It's a step along the way to getting your book out there.
Celine Dion has a singing coach. Tiger Woods has or had a golfing coach. And Grammar Girl has an editor.
Of course.
My life is complete. My life, there's hope. There's hope for all of us then.
Absolutely.
Well, any parting words or pearls of wisdom that you'd like to leave with our listeners before I let you get back to saving the world from a hatred of language my mind is completely gone blank. What do we call it whenever we're texting and we don't and we use shorthand, you know, BRB you instead of YOU.
Yeah. Text messaging abbreviations. Yeah, that's just what I call them. I guess my final words of advice would be, you know, number one, just start. Like, make yourself start. And a good way to do that actually can be to have some kind of deadline or some sort of support group there to, you know, be expecting work from you maybe. So, you know, if you're really serious, number one, just start. And number two, try to find a writing group. And if you can't find a writing group, there's also online, there's National Novel Writing Month. And it's primarily for fiction authors, but you don't have to be a fiction author. You can be a nonfiction author to follow along. And I'm on the writers board for National Novel Writing Month. And right now they're actually
Of
doing
course
Camp
you are.
NaNoWriMo. So
Of course you
they do that a couple times a year. So you can find online groups and writing groups and support groups too, or like follow along on National Novel Writing Month on Twitter or their website. So that's another great way to get some support for your writing. And then, I'll give a little self plug if you're, if you want to just sort of learn all those writing tips by, fun and osmosis, maybe you could listen to the Grammar Girl podcast, because I, every week, have two or three writing tips and I try to make them fun. So, if you listen for a year, you're getting like
And you do a
100
good
tips.
job.
So,
You do a good
if
job.
I
They're
can help
fun. Like
you.
I said, people think that because of usually because of their experiences in school or college, that grammar and punctuation, that it has to be dry and that it's these set of rules. But you do a wonderful job of showing people how funny that it can be, of how interesting it can be, and of how practical it can be, helping them answer some of the most common things. And in fact, one of the things that I really like about the podcast is that you answer questions that I feel like I have all the time. I go to write an email or a text message, and I have this question. Oh, wait, is it this or that? Okay, well, let me just write around it. So I always have this recurring question, but I never think to go look it up, because it's not like I'm professionally writing or for a website or something like that. It's not something that I need to get right. And you answer all of those questions that I always have, but I never take the time to go look up and find the right answer to.
Right. And with a podcast, you can just hear that while you're, working out at the gym or commuting. So it's a handy way to sort of just absorb that information without having to, go find a book and look it up. I mean, I have books, but, the podcast is a nice way to just, passively learn, sort of.
In a lot of other countries, especially in Europe, a lot of countries have the National Academy of Language, or the National Academy see, I'm trying to think. In Spain, there's the Royal Academy. Brazil has its own, and these are the official governmental, either sponsored or sanctioned institutions that determine these are the rules of language. In Brazilian Portuguese, this body of academics, I think they meet in, must be the capital, Brasilia, I assume. In Spain, it's in Madrid. Paris has their own. Excuse me, France has their own in Paris. We don't have that in the U.S., but I am going to start a petition that we created, and I am nominating you as chairman of the board of directors.
No, I don't think we should have one. I actually don't think that we should have one. I object. language, I do think language should belong to the people, not to some government body that oversees what's right and wrong. I think that, the way I described it in my
Oh,
TED
a
talk is that
libertarian after my own heart.
we vote, the people, we vote with our usage. So, when we, what's a good example? So, a long time ago, people thought that we shouldn't use the word drapes to refer to curtains. They thought that was horrible, that drapes was just a terrible word. But you know what? We all like the word drapes. We use the word drapes, and now nobody objects to the word drapes. But if we had a body like the French Academy, they might rule from on high that we shouldn't use drapes. And I just really prefer to let the people vote. And I'll end with a funny story, because I was in France a couple of weeks ago for the first time, on vacation, and I really wasn't thinking about work at all. And then suddenly it occurred to me, I'm in France, the land of the French Academy. And I said this out loud, and my husband looked at me. He's like, "You are so weird." and I was so excited to be in the land of the French Academy. So, gives you a sense of how I see the world.
Well, you know, blessed are the weird. Well, Leon, thank you so much for all of this today. This has been fun, but you know what? I think that it's probably one of the most inspirational episodes that that we've probably had on this podcast. Just the idea that someone as steeped in grammar and language as you are, to have been so transparent and honest and encouraging has been, well, it's been a treat. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about the things I love.
Awesome. So y'all go subscribe to the podcast. It is absolutely worth it. And then I just happened to have picked up The Ultimate Writing Guide for Students, but I realized that I don't have The Ultimate Writing Guide for, or The Ultimate Guide to Better Writing. So I'm going to go, Quick and Dirty Tips for Better Writing. So I just did the one-click ordering from Amazon to have that shipped here so I can enjoy more of her brilliance and pearls of wisdom. All right. Well, thank you again, and much, much appreciated. You have a great day.
Thank you, and good luck to all your listeners. Get those books written.
Beautiful advice. Beautiful way to end. Thanks.